The old poet had never given a shit about the military. Idiots, all of them. But Cassad had told an interesting tale, lived an interesting life. The other priest, Lennar Hoyt, had been a prig and an asshole, but the first one, the one with the sad eyes and the leather journal, Paul Doré, there had been a man worth writing about. Martin Silenus drifted back to sleep with the light of morning flooding in on him, illuminating his countless wrinkles and translucent parchment flesh, his blue veins visible and pulsing weakly in the rich light. He did not dream, but part of his poet's mind was already outlining the next sections of his never-finished cantos. Sergeant Gregorius had not been exaggerating. Father Captain Tosoya had been terribly battered and burned in the last battle of his ship, the Raphael, and was near death. The sergeant had led Abetic, Ania, and me into the temple. The structure was as strange as this encounter. Outside there was a large blank stone tablet, a smooth-faced monolith. Ania mentioned briefly that it had been brought from Old Earth, had stood outside the original temple of the Jade Emperor, and had never been inscribed during its thousands of years on the Pilgrim's Trail. While inside the sealed and pressurized courtyard of the echoing temple itself, a stone railing ran around a boulder that was actually the summit of Tai Shan, the sacred great peak of the Middle Kingdom. There were small sleeping and eating rooms for pilgrims in the back of the huge temple, and it was in one of these that we found Father Captain Tosoya and the other two survivors. Besides Gregorius and the dying Tosoya, there were two other men. Carol Shan, a weapons systems officer, now terribly burned and unconscious, and Hogan Leibler, introduced by Sergeant Gregorius as the former executive officer of the Raphael. Leibler was the least injured of the four. His left forearm had been broken and was in a sling, but he had no burns or other impact bruises. But there was something quiet and withdrawn about the thin man, as if he were in shock or mulling something over. Ania's attention went immediately to Captain Federico Tosoya. The priest captain was on one of the uncomfortable pilgrim cots, either stripped to the waist by Gregorius, or he had lost all of his upper uniform in the blast and re-entry. His trousers were shredded. His feet were bare. The only place on his body where he had not been terribly burned was the parasite cruciform on his chest. It was a healthy, sickening pink. Tosoya's hair had been burned away, and his face was splashed with liquid metal burns and radiation slashes. But I could see that he had been a striking man, mostly because of his liquid, troubled brown eyes, not dulled even by the pain that must be overwhelming him at this moment. Someone had applied burn cream, temporary derm heal, and liquid disinfectant all over the visible portions of the dying priest captain's body, and started a standard lifeboat medkit IV drip. But this would have little effect on the outcome. I had seen combat burns like this before, not all from starship encounters. Three friends of mine during the ice shelf fighting had died within hours when we had not been able to medevac them out. Their screams had been horrible to the point of unendurable. Father Captain Tosoya was not screaming. I could see that he was straining not to cry out from the pain, but he remained silent, his eyes focused only on the terrible concentration to silence until Ania knelt by his side. At first he did not recognize her. "Betts?" he mumbled. "Vero Argyle?" "No. You died at your station. The others, too. Paul Dinish. Elijah trying to free the aft boat. The young troopers when the starboard hull failed. But you look familiar." Ania started to take his hand, saw that three of Tosoya's fingers were missing, and set her own hand on the stained blanket next to his. "Father Captain," she said very softly. "Ania," said Tosoya, his dark eyes really looking at her for the first time. "You are the child. So many months chasing you. Looked at you when you stepped out of the Sphinx. Incredible child. So glad you survived. His gaze moved to me. You are all Endymion. I saw your home guard dossier. Almost caught up to you on Mare Infinitus. A wave of pain rolled over him, and the priest captain closed his eyes and bit into his burned and bloodied lower lip. After a moment, he opened his eyes and said to me, I have something of yours. Personal gear on the Raphael. The Holy Office let me have it after they ended their investigation. Sergeant Gregorius will give it to you after I am dead. I nodded, having no idea what he was talking about. Father Captain DeSoya, whispered Aenea. Federico, can you hear and understand me? Yes, murmured the priest captain. Painkillers. Said no to Sergeant Gregorius. Didn't want to slip away forever in my sleep, not go gently. The pain returned. I saw that much of DeSoya's neck and chest had cracked and opened like burned scales. Pus and fluid flowed down to the blankets beneath him. The man closed his eyes until the tide of agony receded. It took longer this time. I thought of how I had folded up just under the pain of a kidney stone and tried to imagine this man's torment. I could not. Father Captain, said Aenea, there is a way for you to live. DeSoya shook his head vigorously, despite the pain that must have caused. I noticed that his left ear was little more than carbon. Part of it flaked off on the pillow as I watched. No, he cried. I told Gregorius, no partial resurrection. Idiot, sexless idiot. A cough that might have been a laugh from behind scorched teeth. Had enough of that as a priest. Anyway, tired. Tired of... His blackened stubs of fingers on his right hand batted at the pink double cross on his flaked and oozing chest. Let the thing die with me. Aenea nodded. I didn't mean be reborn, Father Captain. I meant live, be healed. DeSoya was trying to blink, but his eyelids were burned ragged. Not a prisoner of the Pax, he managed, finding the air to speak only each time he exhaled with a racking gasp. Will execute me. I deserve it. Killed many innocent men, women, in defense of friends. Aenea leaned closer so that he could focus on her eyes. Father Captain, the Pax is still after us as well. But we have a ship. It has an auto-surgeon. Sergeant Gregorius stepped forward from where he had been leaning wearily against the wall. The man named Carol Shan remained unconscious. Hoag Leibler, apparently lost in some private misery, did not respond. Aenea had to repeat it before DeSoya understood. Ship? Said the priest captain. The ancient hegemony ship you escaped in? Not armed, was it? No, said Aenea. It never has been. DeSoya shook his head again. There must have been 50 Archangel-class ships. Jumped us. Got a few. Rest. Still there. No chance. Get to any translation point. Before. He closed his torn eyelids again, while the pain washed over him. This time, it seemed, it almost carried him away. He returned as if from a far place. It's all right, whispered Aenea. I'll worry about that. You'll be in the dock in the box. But there's something you would have to do. Father Captain DeSoya seemed too tired to speak, but he shifted his head to listen. You have to renounce the cruciform, said Aenea. You have to surrender this type of immortality. The priest captain's blackened lips pulled back from his teeth. Gladly, he rasped. But sorry. Can't. Once accepted. Cruciform. Can't be surrendered. Yes, whispered Aeneia. It can. If you choose that, I can make it go away. Our auto-surgeon is old. It would not be able to heal you with the cruciform parasite throughout your body. We have no resurrection creche aboard the ship. De Sawyer reached for her then, his flaking and three-fingerless hand still gripping tightly the sleeve of her therm jacket. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if I die. Get it off. Get it off. We'll die a real Catholic again. If you can help me, get it off. He almost shouted the final word. Aeneia turned to the sergeant. Do you have a cup or glass?
There's the mug in the med kit, rumbled the giant, fumbling for it. But we have no water.
I brought some, said my friend, and removed the insulated bottle from her belt. I expected wine, but it was only the water we had bottled up before leaving the temple hanging in air those endless hours ago. Aeneia did not bother with alcohol swabs or sterile lancets. She beckoned me closer, removing the hunting knife from my belt, and drew the blade across three of her fingertips in a swift move that made me flinch. Her blood flowed red. Aeneia dipped her fingers in the clear plastic drinking mug for just a second, but long enough to send currents of thick crimson spiraling and twisting in the water. Drink this, she said to Father Captain De Sawyer, helping to lift the dying man's head. The priest captain drank, coughed, drank again. His eyes closed when she eased him back onto the stained pillow. The cruciform will be gone within 24 hours, whispered my friend. Father Captain De Sawyer made that rough chuckling sound again.
I'll be dead within an hour.
You'll be in the auto-surgeon within 15 minutes, said Aeneia, touching his better hand. Sleep now, but don't die on me, Federico De Sawyer. Don't die on me. We have much to talk about, and you have one great service to perform for me, for us. Sergeant Gregorius was standing closer.
Aeneia,
he said, halted, shuffled his feet, and tried again.
Aeneia, may I partake of that water?
Aeneia looked at him. Yes, Sergeant. But once you drink, you can never again carry a cruciform. Never. There will be no resurrection, and there are other side effects. Gregorius waved away any further discussion.
I have followed my captain for 10 years. I will follow him now.
The giant drank deeply of the pinkish water. De Sawyer's eyes had been closed, and I had assumed that he was asleep or unconscious from the pain. But now he opened them and said to Gregorius,
Sergeant, would you please bring Emendymion the parcel we dragged from the lifeboat? Aye, Captain, said the giant, and rummaged through the litter of debris in one corner of the room.
He handed me a sealed tube, a little over a meter high. I looked at the priest captain. De Sawyer seemed to be floating between delirium and shock. I'll open it when he's better, I said to the sergeant. Gregorius nodded, carried the glass over to Carol Shan, and poured some water into the unconscious weapons officer's gaping mouth.
Carol may die before your ship arrives, said the sergeant.
He looked up.
Or does the ship have two dock in the boxes?
No, said Aeneia. But the one we have has three compartments. You can heal your wounds as well. Gregorius shrugged. He went to the man named Leibler and offered the glass. The thin man with the broken arm only looked at it. Perhaps later, said Aeneia. Gregorius nodded and handed the glass back to her.
The XO was a prisoner on our ship, said the sergeant. A spy, an enemy of the captain. Father Captain still risked his last life to get Leibler out of the brig, got his burns retrieving him. I don't think Ho quite understands what's happened.
Leibler looked up then. I understand it, he said softly. I just don't understand it. Aeneas stood. Rawl, I hope you haven't lost the ship communicator. I fumbled in my pockets only a few seconds before coming up with the comm unit disk key journal.
I'll go outside and tight beam visually, I said. Use the skin suit, Jack. Any instructions for the ship?
Tell it to hurry, said Aeneas. It was tricky getting the semi-conscious to Soya and the unconscious Carol Shan to the ship. They had no spacesuits, and it was still near vacuum outside. Sergeant Gregorius told us that he had used an inflatable transfer ball to drag them from the lifeboat wreckage to the Temple of the Jade Emperor, but the ball itself had been damaged. I had about 15 minutes to think about the problem before the ship became visible, descending on its EM repellers and blue fusion flame tail. So when it arrived, I ordered it to land directly in front of the temple airlock, to morph its escalator ramp to the airlock door, and to extend its containment field around the door and stairway. Then it was just a matter of getting the float litters from the medbay and the ship and transferring the men to them without hurting them too much. Sean remained unconscious, but some of DeSoya's skin peeled away as we moved him onto the litter. The priest captain stirred and opened his eyes, but did not cry out. After months on Tien Shan, the interior of the consul's ship was still familiar, but familiar like a recurring dream one has about a house one has lived in long ago. After DeSoya and the weapons officer were tucked away in the auto surgeon, it was strange to stand on the carpeted hollow pit deck with its ancient Steinway piano, with Aeneas and A. Bedick there as always, but also with a burned giant still holding his assault weapon and the former XO brooding silently on the hollow pit stairs.
Diagnostics completed on the autosurgeons, said the ship. The presence of the cross-shaped parasite nodes makes treatment impossible at this time. Shall I terminate treatment or commence cryogenic fugue?
Cryogenic fugue, said Aeneas. The doc in the box should be able to operate on them in 24 hours. Please keep them alive and in stasis until then.
Affirmative, said the ship, and then, Aeneas? Amendimian?
Yes, I said.
Are you aware that I was tracked by long-range sensors from the time I left the third moon? There are at least 37 Pax warships heading this way as we speak. One is already in parking orbit around this planet, and another has just committed the highly unusual tactic of jumping on Hawking Drive within the system's gravity well.
Okay, said Aeneas. Don't worry about it.
I believe they intend to intercept and destroy us, said the ship, and they can do this before we clear atmosphere.
We know, sighed Aeneas. I repeat, don't worry about it.
Affirmative, said the ship in the most businesslike tone I had ever heard from it. Destination?
The Banzai Fissure, 6 kilometers east of Swan Kung Su, said Aeneas.
East of the temple hanging in air, quickly.
She glanced at her wrist chronometer. But stay low, ship, within the cloud layers.
The phosgene clouds or the water particle clouds? Inquired the ship.
The lowest possible, said my friend. Unless the phosgene clouds create a problem for you.
Of course not, said the ship. Would you like me to plot a course that would take us through the acid seas? It would make no difference to the Pax Deep radar, but it could be done with only a small addition of time and...
No, interrupted Aeneas. Just the clouds.
We watched on the hollow pit sphere view as the ship flung itself off Suicide Cliff and dived 10 kilometers through gray cloud and then into green clouds. We would be at the fissure within minutes. We all sat on the carpeted hollow pit steps then. I realized that I still had the sealed tube that DeSoya had given me. I rotated it through my hands.
Go ahead and open it, said Sergeant Gregorius.
The big man was slowly removing the outer layers of his scarred combat armor. Lance burns had melted the lower layers. I was afraid to see his chest and left arm. I hesitated. I had said that I'd wait until the priest captain had recovered.
Go ahead, Gregorius said again. The captain's been waiting to give this back to you for 9 years.
I had no idea what it could be. How could this man have known he would see me someday? I owned nothing,
How could he have something of mine to return?
I broke the seal on the tube and looked within. Some sort of tightly rolled fabric. With a slow realization, I pulled the thing out and unrolled it on the floor. Anea laughed delightedly.
My God, she said. In all my various dreams about this time, I never foresaw this. How wonderful! It was the hawking mat, the flying carpet that had carried Anea and me from the Valley of the Time Tombs almost 10 years earlier. I had lost it. It took me a second or two to remember. I had lost it on Mare Infinitus 9 years ago, when the Pax lieutenant I had been fighting had pulled a knife, cut me, pushed me off the mat into the sea. What had happened next? The lieutenant's own men on the floating sea platform had mistakenly killed him with a cloud of flechette darts. The dead man had fallen into the violent sea, and the hawking mat had flown on. No, I remembered that someone on the platform had intercepted it.
How did the father captain get it? I asked, knowing the answer as soon as I articulated the question.
De Soia had been our relentless pursuer then.
Gregorius nodded.
The father captain used it to find your blood and DNA samples. It's how we got your Pax service record from Hyperion. If we'd had pressure suits, I would have used the damn thing to get off that airless mountain.
You mean it works? I tapped the flight threads. The hawking mat, more tattered than I remembered it, hovered 10 meters off the floor.
I'll be damned, I said.
We're rising to the fissure at the coordinates you gave me, came the ship's voice. The hollow pit view cleared and showed the Jo Kung Ridge rushing past. We slowed and hovered 100 meters out. We had returned to the same forested valley fissure where the ship had dropped me more than 3 months earlier. Only now the Green Valley was filled with people. I saw Theo, Lomo, many of the others from the temple hanging in air. The ship floated lower, hovered and waited for directions.
Lower the escalator, said Anea. Let them all aboard.
May I remind you, said the ship, that I have fugue couches and life support for a maximum of 6 people for an extended interstellar jump? There are at least 50 people there on the...
Lower the escalator and let them all aboard, commanded Anea, immediately.
The ship did as it was told without another word. Theo led the refugees up the ramp and the circular stairs to where we waited. Most of those who had stayed behind at the temple hanging in air were there. Many of the temple monks, the Tromo Trochi of Domu, the ex-soldier Gyalo Thondup, Lomo Dondrub, we were delighted to see that his paraglider had brought him safely back. And from his grins and hugs, the delight was reciprocated. Abbot Kempo Nga Wang Tashi, Chim Din, Jigme Taring, Kuku and Kay, George and Jigme, the Dalai Lama's brother Lapsang, the brickworkers Vicky and Kim, overseer Tsipon Shikapa, Rimsi Kiyapup, less dour than I had ever seen him, and high riggers Haruyuki and Kenshiro, as well as the bamboo experts Wojtek and Janusz, even the mayor of Jo Kung, Charles Chikyap Kempo. But no Dalai Lama, and the Dorji Fama was also missing.
Rachel went back to fetch them, said Theo, the last to come aboard. The Dalai Lama insisted on being the last to leave, and the sow stayed behind to keep him company until it was time to go. But they should have been back by now. I was just ready to go back along the ledge to check.
Anea shook her head. We'll all go. There was no way to get everyone seated or situated. People milled on the stairways, stood around the library level, had wandered up to the bedroom at the apex of the ship to look outside via the viewing walls, while others were on the fugue cubby level and down in the engine room.
Let's go, ship, said Anea. The temple hanging in air, make a direct approach.
For the ship, a direct approach was a burst of thruster fire, a lob 15 clicks into the atmosphere, and then a vertical drop with repellers and main engine burning at the last second. The entire process took about 30 seconds, but while the internal containment field kept us from being smashed to jelly, the view through the clear apex walls must have been disorienting for those watching upstairs. Anea, Abetic, Theo, and I were watching the hollow pit, and even that small view almost sent me to clutching the bulkheads or clinging to the carpet. We dropped lower and hovered 50 meters above the temple complex.
Ah, damn, said Theo.
The view had shown us a man falling to his death in the clouds below. There was no possibility of swooping down to catch him. One second he was free-falling, the next he had been swallowed by the clouds.
Who was it? Said Theo.
Ship, said Aenea. Playback and enhance. Carl Lingo William I. Hagee, the Dalai Lama's bodyguard. A few seconds later, several figures emerged from the right meditation pavilion onto the highest platform, the one I had helped build to Aenea's plans less than a month ago. Shit, I said aloud. The Nemes thing was carrying the Dalai Lama in one hand, holding him over the edge of the platform. Behind her, behind it, came her male and female clone siblings. Then Rachel and the Dorji Famo stepped out of the shadows onto the platform. Aenea gripped my arm.
Rol, do you want to come outside with me?
She had activated the balcony beyond the Steinway, but I knew that this was not all that she meant. Of course, I said, thinking, is this her death? Is this what she has foreseen since before birth? Is it my death? Of course I'll come, I said. Abetic and Theo started out onto the ship's balcony with us.
No, said Aenea, please.
She took the android's hand for a second.
You can see everything from inside, my friend.
I would prefer to be with you, Aenea, said Abetic.
Aenea nodded.
But this is for Rol and me alone.
Abetic lowered his head a second and returned to the hollow pit image. None of the rest of the score of people in the library level and on the spiral stairs said a word. The ship was dead silent. I walked out onto the balcony with my friend. Nemes still held the boy out over the drop. We were 20 meters above her and her siblings now. I wondered idly how high they could jump.
Hey!
Shouted Aenea. Nemes looked up. I was reminded that the effect of her gaze was like being stared at by empty eye sockets. Nothing human lived there.
Put him down, said Aenea.
Nemes smiled and dropped the Dalai Lama, catching him with her left hand at the last second.
Be careful what you ask for, child, said the pale woman.
Let him and the other two go and I'll come down, said Aenea.
Nemes shrugged.
You won't leave here anyway, she said, her voice not raised but perfectly audible across the gap.
Let them go and I'll come down, repeated Aenea. Nemes shrugged, but threw the Dalai Lama across the platform like an unwanted wad of paper. Rachel ran to the boy, saw that he was hurt and bleeding, but alive, lifted him and turned back angrily toward Nemes and her siblings.
No!
Shouted Aenea. I had never heard her use that tone before. It froze both Rachel and me in our tracks.
Rachel, said Aenea, her voice level again. Please bring His Holiness and the Dorji Famo up to the ship now.
It was polite, but an imperative that I could not have resisted. Rachel did not. Aenea gave the command and the ship dropped lower, morphing and extending a stairway from the balcony. Aenea started down. I hurried to follow her. We stepped onto the bonsai cedar platform. I had helped to place all of the planks, and Rachel led the child and old woman past us up the stairway. Aenea touched Rachel's head as the other woman went past. The stairway flowed uphill and shaped itself back into a balcony. Theo and Abetic joined Rachel and the Dorji Famo on it. Someone had taken the bleeding child into the ship. We stood 2 meters from Radamanth Nemes. Her siblings stepped up to the creature's side.
This is not quite complete, said Nemes. Where is your...
Ah, there.
The shrike flowed from the shadows of the pavilion. I say flowed, for although it moved, I had not seen it walk. I was clenching and unclenching my hands. Everything was wrong for this showdown. I had peeled off my therm jacket in the ship, but still wore the stupid skin suit and climbing harness, although most of the hardware had been left in the ship. The harness in multiple layers would still slow me down. Slow me down from what, I thought. I had seen Nemes fight, or rather, I had not seen her. When she and the shrike had struggled on God's Grove, there had been a blur, then explosions, then nothing. She could decapitate Aenea and have my guts for garters before I got my hands clenched into fists. Fists. The ship was unarmed, but I had left it with Sergeant Gregorius's Swiss Guard assault rifle still on the library level. The first thing they had taught us in the Home Guard was never to fight with fists when you could scrounge up a weapon. I looked around. The platform was clean and bare, not even a railing I could wrench free to use as a club. This structure was too well built to rip anything loose. I glanced at the cliff wall to our left. No loose rocks there. There were a few pitons and climbing bolts still embedded in the fissures there, I knew. We had clipped onto them while building this level and pavilion, and we hadn't gotten around to clearing all of them. But they were driven in far too tight for me to pull out and use as a weapon, although Nemes could probably do so with one finger. And what good would a piton or chalk nut do against this monster? There were no weapons to find here. I would die barehanded. I hoped that I would get one blow in before she took me down, or at least one swing. Aenea and Nemes were looking only at each other. Nemes did not spare more than a glance at the shrike 10 paces to her right. The female thing said, "You know that I am not going to take you back to the packs, don't you, child bitch?" "Yes," said Aenea. She returned the creature's stare with a solid intensity. Nemes smiled. "But you believe that your spiked creature will save you again?" "No," said Aenea. "Good," said Nemes, "because it will not." She nodded to her clone siblings. I know their names now, Scylla and Briareus, and I know what I saw next. I should not have been able to see it, for all three of the Nemes things phase-shifted at that instant. There should have been the briefest glimpse of a chrome blur, then chaos, then nothing. But Aenea reached over and touched the back of my neck. There was the usual electric tingle I received whenever her skin touched mine, and suddenly the light was different. Deeper, darker, and the air was as thick as water around us. I realized that my heart did not seem to be beating, and that I did not blink or take a breath. As alarming as that sounds, it seemed irrelevant then. Aenea's voice whispered from the hear patch on my folded back skin suit cowl. Or perhaps it spoke directly through her touch on my neck, I could not tell. "We cannot phase shift with them or use it to fight them," she said. "It is an abuse of the energy of the void which binds. But I can help us watch this." And what we watched was incredible enough. At Nemesis' command, Scylla and Briareus threw themselves at the shrike, while the Hyperion demon raised 4 arms and threw itself in the direction of Nemes, only to be intercepted by the siblings. Even with our altered vision, the ship hanging frozen in midair, our friends on the balcony frozen into unblinking statues, a bird above the cliff face locked into the thick air like an insect in amber. The sudden movement of the shrike and the 2 cloned creatures was almost too fast to follow. There was a terrible impact just a meter short of Nemes, who had turned into a silver-surfaced effigy of herself, and who did not flinch. Briareus threw a blow that I am convinced would have split our ship in 2. It reverberated off the shrike's thorned neck with a sound like an underwater earthquake played back in slow motion, and then Scylla kicked the shrike's legs out from under it. The shrike went down, but not before 2 of its arms seized Scylla and 2 other razor-fingered claws sank deep into Briareus. The Nemes siblings seemed to welcome the embrace, throwing themselves onto the tumbling shrike with clacking teeth and flying nails. I could see that the hurtling edges of their rigid hands and forearms were razor-sharp, guillotine surfaces sharper than the shrike's blades and thorns. The 3 beat and chewed on each other in a wild frenzy, rolling across the platform, throwing bonsai cedar chips 3 meters into the air and slamming against the rock wall. In a second, all 3 were on their feet, the shrike's great jaws clamping on Briareus's neck, even as Scylla slashed at one of the creature's 4 arms, bent it backward, and seemed to break it at a joint.
still holding Briareus in its jaws, the huge teeth chewing and scraping at the silver form's head. The shrike whirled to confront Scylla, but by then both clone siblings had their hands on the blades and thorns on the shrike's skull, bending it backward until I waited to hear the neck snap and see its head roll away. Instead, Nemes somehow communicated, "Now, do it!" And without an instant's hesitation, the two siblings threw themselves away from the cliff face toward the railing at the abyss-end side of the platform. I saw what they were going to do, throw the shrike into space, just as they had done to the Dalai Lama's bodyguard. Perhaps the shrike saw this as well, for the tall creature slammed the two chrome bodies against it, its chest spikes and wrist thorns sinking deep into the force fields around the struggling, clawing siblings. The trio whirled and tumbled and bounced up like some demented, three-part wind-up toy, locked into hyper-fast berserk mode, until finally the shrike, with its kicking, clawing, visibly impaled forms, slammed into the sturdy cedar railing, tore through it as though it were wet cardboard, and went hurtling out over and into the drop, still fighting. Anea and I watched as the tall silver form with flashing spikes and the shorter silver forms with flailing limbs fell, grew smaller and smaller, fell into clouds and were swallowed. I knew that those watching from the ship would have seen nothing except a sudden disappearance of three of the figures on our platform, and then a broken railing and an emptier platform with just Nemes, Anea, and me remaining. The silver thing that was Radamanth Nemes turned its featureless chrome face toward us. The light changed. The breeze blew again. The air thinned. I felt my heart suddenly beating again, pounding loudly, and I blinked rapidly. Nemes was in her human form again. "So," she said to Anea, "shall we finish this little farce?" "Yes," said Anea. Nemes smiled and went to phase shift. Nothing happened. The creature frowned and seemed to concentrate. Still nothing occurred. "I can't stop you from phase shifting," said Anea. "But others can, and have." Nemes looked irritated for a second, but then laughed. "Those who created me will attend to that in a second. But I do not wish to wait that long. And I do not need to shift up to kill you, bitch child." "That's true," said Anea. She had stood her ground through all of this violence and confusion, her legs apart, feet firmly planted, arms easy at her sides. Nemes showed her small teeth, but I saw that these teeth were elongating, growing sharper, as if being extruded farther from her gums and jawbone. There were at least three rows of them. Nemes held up her hands and her fingernails, already pale and long, extended another 10 centimeters, flowing into gleaming spikes. Nemes reached down with those sharpened nails and peeled back the skin and flesh of her right forearm, revealing some sort of metallic endoskeleton that was the color of steel but which looked infinitely sharper. "Now," said Nemes. She stepped toward Anea. I stepped between them. "No," I said, and raised my fists like a boxer ready to start. Nemes showed all of her rows of teeth.
Audible Frontiers presents The Rise of Endymion, written by Dan Simmons and read by Victor Bavine.
Chapter 23. Time and motion seem to slow again, as if I can once again see in the phase shift mode. But this time, it is merely the effect of adrenaline and total concentration. My mind shifts into overdrive. My senses become preternaturally alert. I see, feel, and calculate every microsecond with uncanny clarity. Nemes takes a step, more toward Aenea to my left than toward me. This is a chess match more than a fight. I win if I kill the unfeeling bitch or fling her off the platform long enough for us to escape. She does not have to kill me to win. Only neutralize me long enough to kill Aenea. Aenea is her target. Aenea has always been her target. This monster was created to kill Aenea. Chess match. Nemesis has just sacrificed two of her strongest pieces, her monster siblings, to neutralize our knight, the Shrike. Now all three pieces are off the board. Only Nemes, the Dark Queen, Aenea, humankind's queen, and Aenea's lowly pawn, me. This pawn may have to sacrifice himself, but not without taking out the Dark Queen. Of that he is determined. Nemes is smiling. Her teeth are sharp and redundant. Her arms are still at her sides, long nails gleaming, her right forearm exposed like some obscene surgical exhibit. The interior not human, no, not human at all. The cutting edge of her forearm endoskeleton catches the afternoon sunlight. Aenea, I say softly, step back, please. This highest of platforms connects to the stone walkway and staircase we had cut to climb to the overhang walkway. I want my friend off the platform. Rawl, I do it now, I say, not raising my voice but putting into it every bit of command I have learned and earned in my 32 standard years of life. Aenea takes 4 steps back onto the stone ledge. The ship continues to hover 50 meters out and above us. There are many faces peering from the balcony. I try to will Sergeant Gregorius to step out and use his assault rifle to blow this Nemes bitch thing away. But I do not see his dark face among those staring. Perhaps he has been weakened by his wounds. Perhaps he feels that this should be a fair fight. Fuck that, I think. I do not want a fair fight. I want to kill this Nemes creature any way I can. I would gladly accept any help from anywhere right now. Is the Shrike really dead? Can this be? Martin Silenus's contos seem to tell of the Shrike being defeated in some far future battle with Colonel Fedmon Kassad. But how did Silenus know this? And what does the future mean to a monster capable of traveling through time? If the Shrike was not dead, I would appreciate its return about now. Nemes takes another step to her right, my left. I step left to block her access to Aenea. Under phase shift, this thing has superhuman strength and can move so fast as to be literally invisible. She can't phase shift now. I hope to God. But she still may be faster and stronger than me, than any human. I have to assume that she is, and she has the teeth, claws, and cutting arm. "Ready to die, Rawl Endymion?" says Nemes, her lips sliding back from those rows of teeth. Her strengths, probable speed, strength, and inhuman construction. She may be more robot or android than human. It is almost certain that she does not feel pain. She may have other built-in weapons that she has not revealed. I have no idea how to kill or disable her. Her skeleton is metal, not bone. The muscles visible in her forearm look real enough, but may be made of plastic fibers or pink steel mesh. It is unlikely that normal fighting techniques will stop her. Her weaknesses? I do not know. Perhaps overconfidence. Perhaps she has become too used to phase-shifting, to killing her enemies when they cannot fight back. But she had taken on the Shrike and fought it to a draw 9.5 years ago, beaten it, actually, since she had gotten it out of the way to get to Aenea. Only the intervention of Father Captain DeSoya's ship, lancing her with every gigavolt available on the starship, had prevented her from killing all of us. Nemes raises her arms now and crouches, clawed fingers extended. How far can the thing jump? Can it jump over me to get to Aenea? My strengths. 2 years boxing for the regiment during my home guard tour. I hated it. Lost about 1/3 of my matches. The others in my regiment kept betting on me, though. Pain never stopped me. I certainly felt it, but it never stopped me.
blows to the face made me see red. Early on, I would forget all of my training when someone hit me in the face. And when the red mist of fury cleared, if I was still standing, I tended to have won the match. But I know that blind fury will not help me now. If I lose focus for an instant, this thing will kill me. I was fast when I boxed, but that was more than a decade ago. I was strong, but I have not formally trained or worked out in all the intervening years. I could take hard blows in the ring, which is different than giving in to pain. I'd never been knocked out in the ring, even when a better fighter had sent me down a dozen times before the fight was called. Besides boxing, I'd been a bouncer at one of the bigger Nine Tails casinos on Felix. But that was mostly psychology, knowing how to avoid fighting while moving the obnoxious drunk out the door. I had made sure that the few actual fights were over in a few seconds. I had been trained for hand-to-hand fighting in the home guard, taught to kill at close range. But that sort of business was about as rare as a bayonet charge. While working as a bargeman, I had gotten into my most serious fights. Once with a man ready and willing to carve me up with a long knife. I had survived that, but that other bargeman had knocked me out. As a hunting guide, I'd survived an off-worlder coming at me with a flechette gun, but I had accidentally killed him, and he had testified against me after he was resurrected. Come to think of it, that's how all this started. Of all my weaknesses, this was the most serious. I do not really want to hurt anyone. In all of my fights, with the possible exception of the barge master with a knife and the Christian hunter with his flechette gun, I had held something back, not wanting to hit them as hard as I could, not wanting to hurt them too badly. I have to change that way of thinking immediately. This is no person. This is a killing machine, and if I do not disable or destroy it quickly, it will kill me even more quickly. Nemus jumps at me, claws raking, her right arm pulling back and then slashing like a scythe. I jump back, dodge the scythe, almost dodge all the claws, see the shirt on my left upper arm shred, see blood mist the air, and then I step in quickly and hit her fast, hard, 3 times to the face. Nemus jumps back as quickly as she came in. There is blood on the long nails of her left hand. My blood. Her nose has been smashed flat so that it lies sideways on her thin face. I have broken something. Bone, cartilage, metal fiber, where her left brow was. There is no blood on her face. She does not seem to notice any of the damage. She is still grinning. I glance at my left arm. It burns ferociously. Poison? Perhaps it makes sense, but if she uses poison, I should be dead in seconds. No reason she would use long-acting agents. Still here. Just burns because of the slashes. 4, I think. Deep, but not muscle deep. They don't matter. Concentrate on her eyes. Guess what she'll do next. Never use your bare hands. Home guard teaching. Always find a weapon for close-in fighting. If one's personal weapon is destroyed or missing, find something else. Improvise. A rock, a heavy branch, a torn piece of metal. Even stones wrapped in one's fist or keys between the fingers are preferable to one's bare hands. Knuckles break more quickly than jawbones, the drill instructor always reminded us. If you absolutely have to use only hands, use the flat of your hand to chop. Use rigid fingers to impale. Use clawed fingers to go for the eyes and Adam's apple. No loose rocks here, no branches, no keys, no weapons at all. This thing has no Adam's apple. I suspect that her eyes are as cool and hard as marbles. Nemes moves to the left again, glancing toward Aenea. I'm coming, sweetheart, hisses the thing to my friend. I catch a glimpse of Aenea out of the corner of my eye. She is standing on the ledge just beyond the platform. She is not moving. Her face is impassive. This is unlike my beloved. Normally, she would be throwing stones, leaping on an enemy's back. Anything but allowing me to fight this thing alone. This is your moment, Rall, my darling. Her voice is as clear as a whisper in my mind. It is a whisper. Coming from the auditory pickups in my folded back skin suit cowl. I am still wearing the damned thing, as well as my useless climbing harness.
I start to sub-vocalize in response, but remember that I jacked into the ship's communicator in my upper pocket when I called the ship from the summit of Tian Shan, and I will be broadcasting to the ship as well as Ania if I use it now. I move to my left, blocking the creature's way again. Less room to maneuver now. Nemes moves faster this time, feinting left and slashing in from my right, swinging her right arm backhand toward my ribs. I leap back, but the blade slices meat just below my lowest right rib. I duck, but her claws flash. Her left claws go for my eyes. I duck again, but her fingers slice a section of my scalp away. For an instant, the air is filled with atomized blood again. I take one step and swing my own right arm backhand, chopping down as if I were swinging a sledgehammer, my fist connecting with the side of her neck just below her right jawline. Synthetic flesh pulps and tears. The metal and tubes beneath do not bend. Nemes slashes backhand again with her scythe arm and claws with her left hand. I leap away. She misses completely. I step in quickly and kick the back of her knees, hoping to sweep her legs out from under her. It is 8 meters to the broken railing at the far edge. If I could get her rolling, even if we both go over. It is like kicking a steel stanchion. My leg goes numb at the force of my kick, but she does not budge. Fluids and flesh collapse over her endoskeleton, but she does not lose her footing. She must weigh twice what I do. She kicks back and breaks a left rib or two of mine. I hear them crack. The wind goes out of me suddenly, explosively. I reel backward, half expecting a ring rope to be there, but there is only the cliff face, a wall of hard, slick, vertical rock. A piton bolt slams into my back, stunning me for an instant. I know now what I will do. The next breath is like breathing through fire, so I quickly take several more painful breaths, confirming that I can breathe, trying to get my wind back. I feel lucky. I don't think the broken ribs have penetrated my left lung. Nemes opens her arms to prevent my escape and moves in closer. I step into her foul embrace, getting inside the killing sweep of the bladed forearm, and bring my fists together as hard as I can on either side of her head. Her ears pulp. This time there is a yellow fluid filling the air, but I feel the permasteel solidity of the skull under the bruised flesh. My hands rebound. I stagger backward, hands and arms and fists temporarily useless. Nemes leaps. I lean back on the rock, raise both legs, catch her on the chest as she descends, and kick out with all of the strength in my body. She slashes as she flies backward, slicing through part of my harness, most of my jacket and skin suit, and the muscle above my chest. It is on the right side of my chest. She has not cut through the comlink. Good. She backflips and lands on her feet, still 5 meters from the edge. There is no way that I am going to get her to and over the platform edge. She will not play the game under my rules. I rush her, fists raised. Nemes brings her left hand up, cupped and clawed, in a quick disemboweling scoop. I have slid to a stop, millimeters short of that death blow, and now, as she pulls her right arm back in preparation to scythe me in two, I pivot on one foot and kick her in her flat chest with all the strength of my body. Nemes grunts and bites at my leg, her jaws snapping forward like a large dog's. Her teeth chew off the heel and sole of my boot, but miss flesh. Catching my balance, I lunge forward again, gripping her right wrist with my left hand to keep the scythe arm from scraping my back clear of flesh down to my spine, and stepping in close to get a handful of her hair. She is snapping at my face, her rows of teeth directly in front of my eyes, the air between us filled with her yellow saliva or blood substitute. I am bending her head back as we pivot, two violent dancers straining against one another. But her lank, short hair is slippery with my blood and her lubricant, and my fingers are slipping. Lunging against her again to keep her off balance, I shift my fingers to her eye sockets and pull back with all of the strength in my arms and upper body. Her head tilts back. 30 degrees. 50, 60. I should be hearing the snap of her spinal cord. 80 degrees. 90. Her neck is bent backward at right angles to her torso, her marble eyes cold against my straining fingers, her wide lips stretching wider as the teeth snap at my forearm. I release her. She comes forward as if propelled by a giant spring. Her claws sink into my back, scrape bone at the right shoulder and left shoulder blade. I crouch and swing short, hard blows, pounding her ribs and belly. 2, 4, 6 fast shots, pivoting inside, the top of my head against her torn and oily chest, blood from my lacerated scalp flowing over both of us. Something in her chest or diaphragm snaps with a metallic twang, and Nemes vomits yellow fluid over my neck and shoulders. I stagger back and she grins at me, sharpened teeth gleaming through the bubbling yellow bile that drips from her chin onto the already slippery boards of the platform. She screams, steam hissing from a dying boiler, and rushes again, scythe arms slicing through the air in an invisible arc. I leap back, 3 meters to the rock wall or ledge where Aeneas stands. Nemes swings back arm, her forearm a propeller, a whizzing pendulum of steel. She can herd me anywhere she wants me now. She wants me dead or out of the way. She wants Aeneas. I jump back, the blade cutting through the fabric just above beltline this time. I have jumped left this time, more toward the rock wall than the ledge. Aeneas is unprotected for this second. I am no longer between her and the creature. Nemes's weakness. I am betting everything. Aeneas on this. She is a born predator. This close to a kill, she cannot resist finishing me. Nemes swings to her right, keeping the option open of leaping toward Aeneas, but also pursuing me toward the cliff face. The scythe swings backhand at my head for a clean decapitation. I trip and roll farther to my left, away from Aeneas. I am on the boards now, legs flailing. Nemes straddles me, yellow fluid spattering my face and chest. She raises the scythe arm, screams, and brings the arm down. Ship! Land on this platform immediately, no discussion! I gasp this into the comm thread pickup as I roll against Nemesis's legs. Her bladed forearm slams into the tough bonsai cedar where my head was a second before. I am under her. The blade of her arm is sunk deep into the dense wood. For just a few seconds, she is bent over to claw at me and does not have the leverage to free the cutting edge. A shadow falls over both of us. The nails of her left hand slash the right side of my head, almost severing my ear, slicing along the jawbone and just missing my jugular. My right hand is palm up under her jaw, trying to keep those teeth from opening and closing on my neck or face. She is stronger than I am. My life depends upon getting out from under her. Her forearm is still stuck in the platform floor, but this serves her purpose, anchoring her to me. The shadow deepens, 10 seconds, no more. Nemes claws my restraining hands away and wrenches the blade from the wood, staggering to her feet. Her eyes move left to where Aeneas stands unguarded. I roll away from Nemes and away from Aeneas, leaving my friend undefended. Claw cold rock to get to my feet. My right hand is useless, some tendon slashed in these final seconds. So I raise my left hand, pull the safety line from my harness. I can only hope it is still intact, and clip the carabiner onto the piton bolt with a metallic slap, like handcuffs slamming home. Nemes pivots to her left, dismissing me now, black marble eyes on Aeneas. My friend stands her ground. The ship lands on the platform, turning off its EM repellers as ordered, allowing its full weight to rest on the wood, crushing the pavilion of right meditation with a terrible splintering, the ship's archaic fins filling most of the space, just missing Nemes and me. The creature glances once over her shoulder at the huge black ship looming above her, obviously dismisses it, and crouches to leap at Aeneas. For a second, I think that the bonsai cedar will hold, that the platform is even stronger than Aeneas' calculations and my experience suggest. But then there is one horrendous, tearing, splintering sound, and the entire top right meditation platform and much of the stairway down to the right mindfulness pavilion tear away from the mountain. I see the people watching from the ship's balcony, thrown back into the interior of the ship as it falls. Ship! I gasp into the comm thread pickup. Hover! Then I turn my attention back to Nemes. The platform falls away beneath her. She leaps toward Aeneas. My friend does not step back. Only the platform falling out from beneath her keeps Nemes from completing her leap. She falls just short, but her claws strike the stone ledge, throw sparks, find a hold. The platform rips and tears away, disintegrating as it tumbles into the abyss, some parts striking the main platform below, tearing it away in places, piling debris at other places. Nemes is dangling from the rock, scrambling with her claws and feet just a meter below where Anea stands. I have 8 meters of safety line. Using my workable left arm, my blood making the rope dangerously slippery, I let out several meters and kick away from the cliff where I dangle. Nemes pulls herself up to where she can get her clawed fingers over the top of the ledge. She finds a ridge or fissure and pulls herself up and out, an expert climber overcoming an overhang. Her body is arched like a bow as her feet scramble on the stone, pulling her higher so that she can throw herself up and over the ledge at Anea, who has not moved. I swing back away from Nemes, bouncing across the rock, feeling the slick stone against my lacerated bare sole where Nemes has torn away my boot, seeing that the rope I am depending upon has been frayed in the struggle, not knowing if it will hold for another few seconds. I put more stress on it, swinging high away from Nemes in a pendulum arc. Nemes pulls herself up onto Anea's ledge, to her knees, getting to her feet a meter from my darling. I swing high, rocks scraping my right shoulder, thinking for one sickening second that I do not have enough speed and line, but then feeling that I do, just enough, just barely enough. Nemes swivels just as I swing up behind her, my legs opening in embrace, then closing around her, ankles crossing. She screams and raises her scythe arm. My groin and belly are unprotected. Ignoring that, ignoring the unraveling line and the pain everywhere, I cling tight as gravity and momentum swing us back. She is heavier than I. For another terrible second I hang connected and she does not budge. But she has not found her balance yet. She teeters on the edge. I arc backward, trying to move my center of gravity toward my bleeding shoulders, and Nemes comes off the ledge. I open my legs immediately, releasing her. She swings her scythe arm, missing my belly by millimeters as I swing back and out, but the motion sends her hurtling forward, farther away from the ledge and rock wall, out over the hole where the platform had been. I scrape out and back along the cliff wall, trying to arrest my momentum. The safety line breaks. I spread eagle across the rock face, begin sliding down. My right hand is useless. My left fingers find a narrow hold. Lose it. I am sliding faster. My left foot finds a ledge a centimeter wide. That and friction hold me against the rock long enough for me to look over my left shoulder. Nemes is twisting as she falls, trying to change her trajectory enough to sink claws or scythe into the remaining edges of the lowest platform. She misses by 4 or 5 centimeters. 100 meters farther down, she strikes a rock outcropping and is propelled farther out above the clouds. Steps, posts, beams, and platform pillars are falling into cloud a kilometer below her. Nemes screams. A shattered calliope scream of pure rage and frustration, and the echo bounces from rock to rock around me. I can no longer hold on. I've lost too much blood and had too many muscles torn away. I feel the rock sliding away under my chest, cheek, palm, and straining left foot. I look to my left to say goodbye to Anea, if only with a gaze. Her arm catches me as I begin to slide away. She has free-climbed out above me along the sheer face as I watch Nemes fall. My heart pounds with the terror that my weight will pull both of us off. I feel myself slipping, feel Anea's strong hand slipping. I am covered in blood. She does not let go. "Rawl," she says, and her voice is shaking, but with emotion, not fatigue or terror. With her foot on the ledge, the only thing holding us against the cliff, she releases her left hand, sweeps it up, and clamps her safety line onto my dangling carabiner, still attached to the piton. We both slide off and away, scraping skin. Anea instantly hugs me with